Though Kevin Youkilis had gotten much recognition as a college baseball player, setting several records at the University of Cincinnati in the Conference USA and being named a consensus All-American in his senior year, he didn't provide much for Major League Baseball teams. And in fact, wasn't drafted until well into the eighth round. On the five marks, or the five tools of a major league player that professional scouts look for, that is speed, fielding ability, throwing ability, hitting ability, and the ability to hit with power. I'm not sure I see the difference between those last two. He only had two. Youkilis was large of body and slow of foot. Did not throw very well. And he hit with reasonable power. And so he appeared as if he was going to languish in the minor league rosters of the Boston Red Sox. Yet in the midst of all of this banality, if being selected to play professional baseball can be considered truly banal, he came to the attention of the back office of the Oakland A's in their iconic, or perhaps iconoclastic, manager, Billy Beane. Beane was obsessed with Kevin Youkilis and tried in many and various ways over several seasons to trade and cajole, to buy and to sell players in order to get Youkilis on the Oakland Athletics. This led many to wonder, what is it that Beane saw in this overweight infielder? What he saw was that in Youkilis' rookie season, he got 50 walks. And his on-base percentage was among some of the greatest in the major leagues. In fact, he garnered a nickname around the Oakland back office. They called him not Youkilis, his given last name, but Youkilis, the Greek god of walks. Something, it turns out, later was pretty offensive to Kevin, being both of Eastern European descent, not Greek, and a devout Jew. But seemingly, Youkilis saw what the rest of baseball for all time did not, the value of the walk. Those familiar with Michael Lewis's analysis of Billy Beane and the early 2000s A's called Moneyball, you know where this is heading. Beane saw the value of the walk. He knew what my little league coaches used to tell me. Art, a walk's as good as a hit. Because you get on base, and from on base is where you score runs. So just wait the pitcher out. But a walk is antithetical to the ego of a young man. It is not the same as a hit. A hit means you make the cracking sound and you run to first base. A walk means you just stand there until you, well, walk. And according to Lewis, that was the foible of baseball for generations, putting too much value on the hit and the batting average and overlooking the walk. And players like Kevin Youkilis, who had raised the art of waiting out pitchers to a high form. In fact, over the course of his 10-year major league career, Youkilis walked 539 times. Now this is the discipline of waiting. We are in the season of waiting. Advent, and for those of you keeping track of such things, we are three candles around. That means we're halfway through our Advent walk towards Christmas, the season of waiting. The season of putting ourselves in the mind of those who came before Christ, who lived in a time when Christ was not, and who waited. Who joined with the prophet Isaiah and the prophet John the Baptist in saying, "Are you the one who is to come, or shall we wait? Shall we wait for another?" It is also the time when we are especially mindful of our own waiting, waiting for Christ's return, now nearly 2,000 years delayed. It's a time of us, for us to be expectant for that great and glorious day. It is also a time for us to wait for the manifestation of Christ in our own midst. Those little growing places in our own lives where we see Christ's Spirit dwelling in us so clearly. Advent, as the children's rhyme goes, is a time to wait, not a time to celebrate. But waiting is hard. Thanks be to God, some are naturally better at waiting than others, a fact which psychologist Walter Michel showed in the 1960s and 70s with his famed Stanford marshmallow test. That is, he brought two-year-olds into a room in which there was a table, and on the table he placed a single marshmallow and invited the child to sit down. And then, making some excuse, said, "Oh, I have to go attend to something, but if you wait right here and if you don't eat the marshmallow, I'll come back and I'll give you two." And so the professor left and went to the other side of a two-way mirror and watched as each two-year-old wrestled with the potential of eating the marshmallow left behind by this adult or waiting. And she watched for over 10 years. And he also watched the children of the experiment as they grew over those decades. And later in his career, he and his students published a study that suggested that those children who were able to wait it out, who were able to make it until the researcher returned, ultimately scored higher on standardized testing, did better in life, had better jobs, more satisfying marriages. That the ability to delay gratification was perhaps the most significant skill that a young person can have, and that it is in fact manifest almost naturally in some children and not in others. Waiting is hard, and it's particularly hard for some of us. But the good news is it can be learned, it can be at least habituated. It can be practiced, and you can get better at it. And so, whether it is in the realm of our secular lives or here in the spiritual confines of this church, we practice, and that is what we do in Advent. We practice waiting so that we will be better at waiting. Now, that's easy for you to say, Art. I wonder whether or not you have waited for anything. I wonder if you have followed the advice of James in today's readings. Be patient, beloved. The good things come to those who wait. And by the way, self-delayed gratification is one thing, but what about when the waiting is not self-imposed? What about when what is denied is of more value than a marshmallow? Is the answer to those who suffer still wait? The best is yet to come? I can't think through this particular line of argument without my mind going to Martin Luther King Jr.'s letter from a Birmingham jail, in which he directly addresses this culture of waiting within the church. He offers, and here I quote, an anecdote. "I have just received a letter from a white brother in Texas. He writes, 'All Christians know that the colored people will receive equal rights eventually. But is it possible that you are in too great a religious hurry? It has taken Christianity almost 2,000 years to accomplish what it has. The teachings of Christ take time to come to earth.'" Tired of too often being told that the key to gaining civil liberty was to wait. King uses this anecdote to take white moderates to task on the very issue of waiting and its theological virtue. He writes, "For years now I have heard the word wait. It rings in the ear of every Negro with piercing familiarity. This wait has almost always meant never. We must come to see that justice too long delayed is justice denied. Human progress," he continues, "never rolls in on wheels of inevitability. It comes through the tireless efforts of men willing to be co-workers with God. And without this hard work, time itself becomes an ally of the forces of social stagnation. The time is always right to do right. Now is the time to make the real the promise of democracy. Now is the time to lift the national policy from the quicksand of racial injustice to the solid rock of human dignity." And here, King sounds a lot more like the James that we've come to know and love. The James, not of the final chapter of his letter, but of the preceding four. The James who takes to task the wealthy and the resigned of his time. The spiritually secure who, he says, might say to a brother or sister who comes to them in hunger, "Be peaceful," or "Have peace. Rejoice that the Lord is near. Be filled. Go on your way." James responds, "That's not how you treat someone who's hungry. You give them a fish. You feed them. You allow your work to show forth your faith." And in that way, James sets out for us, along with King and countless generations of prophets, a different understanding of the waiting of the Christian life. A waiting that is simply not sitting by and allowing things to pass on their way, but a waiting that is perhaps better described as patience and discernment. A waiting that evaluates the things in our lives and puts on hold those things that are just about self-gratification, but takes seriously the potential for action in our lives and in the lives of others. And this too can become our Advent discipline. We can put ourselves in a mind of a time when Christ was not, but then act in the lives and in the places where the gospel of Christ has still not been heard or not been fully realized. We can think of the ways in which Christ is becoming manifest in our own lives and then carry that out into the world with a heart that remembers the caring of Christ for those who were closest to him. And we can look forward to the return of Christ in a way that not only foreshadows but begins to realize the great and promised day of the Lord. This is the advent of patience. This is the advent of discernment. Kevin Euclid never did join the Oakland Athletics. He played for 10 years, mostly on the Boston Red Sox, but also, I believe, on the Yankees and maybe the Minnesota Twins. His 539 walks in that 10-year career places him 620th on the all-time list of career walks. His most patient season, 75 walks, doesn't even break the top 100 of single-season walks. Who are the true walk kings? Who are the prophets of patient baseball? Barry Bonds, Babe Ruth, Ricky Henderson, and Ted Williams. arguably four of the most productive offensive players in the history of the game. Be patient, therefore, beloved. As an example of patience, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord.